history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories are there, stories that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we set out to do that, we're better off for it. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Over the next month, the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. will hold ceremonies to mark the 75th anniversaries of some significant World War II moments, like the Battle of the Colmar Pocket, the Battle of Manila, and of course, the Battle of Iwo Jima. But this week marks the 75th anniversary of an incident aboard the aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga that we're going to focus on today. More than 100 men out of the ship's 3,000-man crew were killed or wounded in a pair of kamikaze attacks that day. We heard about it on this show a year and a half ago from one of the last survivors, a plank owner even, from the Ticonderoga, who at the time had never had the opportunity to talk to the family of his best friend who died that day. That is no longer the case, and we're going to update that for you today, and also hear from the nephew of that Gold Star hero and learn where his legacy will be preserved. So to set the stage for that latest twist, we need the story of what happened 75 years ago on January 21st, 1945. And there's no one better equipped to tell it than Bob Mettauer of Santa Maria, California, originally from Queens Village, New York. While his parents and twin sister were praying for him back home in the Big Apple, Bob found himself in the Pacific aboard the Big T, the USS Ticonderoga.
It was the largest aircraft carrier in the world at that time. We had a crew of over 3,000 people, and yes, you know, it was amazing. And of course, you know, you're young, so you just go ahead and do what you have to do.
And everybody has a little different role among that 3,000-man crew. So what was yours? What were your duties on the ship?
Well, I started out in the hydraulic gang, and that was steering gear, anchor windlass, and the elevators that moved the plane from the hangar deck to the flight deck. And I was in the number one elevator pump room, which was way forward, way down in the bilge. And my job there was, when they blew flight quarters, my job was to go down into the pump room and push a button, wait till the pressure got high, open up a valve, and then call up topside and tell them we're ready to go. And they were kind enough to call me in when I talked to them. They said, well, come on up. So I ran all the way from the bilge all the way up to the flight deck, and on the starboard side, the controls for the forward elevator were on the side of the flight deck. And we stood in gratings, look down through where you look through to the water, and that was how they operated with the buttons on the side of the elevator. The ship was loaded with planes, so they couldn't take off by themselves, so they had to be catapulted off. And when they catapulted the planes off, the wing would go right over our head as we were standing there.
I bet that's an experience nothing prepares you for.
No, that's right. It's quite exciting, really. And then they didn't just go, they didn't go right off. They dipped down and went down, and fortunately, there was 60 feet from the flight deck to the water, and they would probably go down to almost touch the water before they would have speed to go on, gone up.
So you're aboard this ship, brand new ship. You just told us what your original role was. What about your first experience with what war is really like, your first taste of an enemy to deal with?
Well, on January 21st in 1945, we had just finished bombing Saigon. So we're down there, and we were coming out to go back to another assignment. We were coming out, we're between the Philippines and Formosa, when we took two kamikazes. And my role there was, they blew general quarters, of course, and my role was to go to the forward mess hall. That was my battle station. And when we got there, the place was full of water up to your knees. And so the first thing we had to do was to get the hatch closed where the water was coming down from the flight deck. And having done that, then we were okay. And we were communicating with Battle Control. So Battle Control told us to get out of there and move to another compartment, which we did, and was dry there. And by this time, there was smoke all over the place. The smoke was being brought in by the blowers that would normally air the place. And we had to put on our gas mask, and the lights were out. So that's where we were. And then Battle Control told us they lost contact with the compartment behind where we originally were, and asked us to go in there and see what was going on. So I think I was one of the first ones that went in. And there was a gentleman, was a chow hall. So this gentleman was sitting there with a pen light flashlight in his hand, and it was on. So I thought he was okay, and I went and picked up one of the other people and took him down to sick bay because they were overcome. They had no gas mask on. And I went back into the compartment. That guy was still sitting there with the flashlight. So I said, "You better get out of here," and he was out cold. So I took him to sick bay.
And when you say take him to sick bay, you had to carry him?
Yes. And then on the second trip, I heard his voice, and it was Eddie Mazur, my best friend. We both worked in the machine shop, and we made weights. He was a body specimen, and we made weights, and I had set aside an apartment up forward above the flight the hangar deck. And when they blew general quarters, he was coming down a ladder when the first plane went through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck and made a piece of charcoal out of Eddie. It was terrible to see.
Well, as I was listening to you describe this, I'm thinking all of this was terrible to see. And what prepares you for that? I mean, you're a 20-year-old kid. Had you guys even experienced anything like this before? Had you seen other ships get hit by kamikazes? Did you know that threat was there?
No, I never saw it, but we knew the threat because we had heard about it. You know, the experience of seeing Eddie, it was immediately I knew there was nothing I could do. So I had to continue doing what I was doing to help the other people. And I still remember that. They'll never leave me.
And this was the guy that you'd spent a lot of time with, that you were probably with just the day before?
Yes, we were in the machine shop. We used to do things together. What he did was he made me cross my arms and cross my legs, and he'd pick me up and press me like I was a weight. That was the kind of a specimen he was. Wonderful young man.
So you come into that hold, that room, and you see him burnt to a crisp. You know he's already gone.
Yes. I knew it, and actually, he's listed as missing in action in this in my book.
I wonder if that's ever been corrected.
I have no way of knowing, but I knew when I saw him, I knew he wasn't missing in action. He was doomed.
And what do you do in a situation like that? I'm sure there's a lot of emotions that come over you, but you're still expected to perform a job.
Exactly, that's just exactly what it was. And there I was helping people out of the other compartment. I just continued to do that. And then, of course, pretty soon, things calmed down, and they told us to go back to our original location, which was, in my case, was the machine shop. And on the way back there, myself and Thompson, who was walking with me, we found my friend Chuck Lodge. And he was without his gas mask. It had expired, and he was having real problems. So he and I, we used my gas mask back and forth so that he could get some fresh air until we got back to the machine shop. And when we got to the machine shop, it looked like nothing had happened at all. It was amazing.
And somewhere in there, there was another job that you ended up with, a pretty gruesome task to help some other sailors who had been injured. What about the bigger picture? I mean, as this is happening, you talk about the smoke everywhere, you're seeing some of the damage to shipmates, including your best friend who's killed. Are you wondering if your ship's going to make it? If you guys might even be sunk by this attack?
No, there was never any threat of that. We weren't worried about it, that at all.
Even though you got hit by two kamikazes?
Right. Well, they didn't damage the hull. You know, the ship itself was intact. All they did was damage the flight deck. So the ship was intact, so there was nothing to worry about.
And maybe before we get to your job of prying these rings off of guys whose hands are burned, maybe you can explain to us where those kamikazes hit on the ship and the extent of the damage. I know you've got some photos in this book that you shared with high school kids before, but for our listeners, paint that picture of where the planes hit and the damage that occurred.
Well, at that time, I had no idea. It wasn't until afterwards that I was able to go up topside and find out what happened. So I had no idea. But what one of them went through the flight deck. It was forward of the island and on the starboard side. Went right through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck. And the other one hit the fire control turret on the island just above where Dixie Kiefer, our skipper, was, and injured him pretty badly, so he had to be taken off the ship.
In fact, in your book, which they produced right at the end of the war, there's a picture of the skipper of the ship, Dixie Kiefer, with a microphone in his hand in a hospital bed and people all around him. What was happening there?
Well, he was so badly injured, they were taking him off to put him on a hospital ship. And he was saying farewell to his crews and you know, keep up the good work and all of that. And there wasn't a dry eye on that ship when he left. He was such a fine man, great leader. And he became a world hero, a national hero.
Well, and you say there wasn't a dry eye on the ship. So I'm wondering, where were you while that was happening? And were you hearing this come over the PA system?
Yeah, I was down in the machine shop. I was down there when it happened. He came over the PA system, and everybody on his ship could hear him. And it was amazing because he was just a wonderful person, a wonderful leader.
Yeah, and I guess, and again, we're bouncing back and forth here a little bit, but I'm just thinking, if I'm a 20-year-old kid, and I've just been through all this, the damage to the ship, knowing how many guys were killed, including my best friend, and then I hear my skipper get on the PA, knowing that he's been wounded and he's getting carried off, did what he had to say help you process the situation you were in or motivate you for what you were going to be dealing with?
Well, to be honest, we were prepared for anything anyway. And the problem was when he was replaced, it just changed the entire attitude on the ship. Everything was different. The morale was different, and the person that took his place was not nearly the man that Dixie Kiefer was.
Well, let's talk some more about January 21st. So you told us some of what you experienced that day, and I'm sure it felt like a pretty long day. I think they hit you around noon, is that right?
Yeah, it was early in the day, yes.
So for the next several hours, it was probably nonstop action and busyness for you?
Well, it didn't, you know, really it didn't last that long, you know, because it happened so fast, and we were able to straighten everything out and get the fires out, and I would say probably an hour, that's all. And by that time, we were back in the machine shop.
And there's a book. You mentioned your daughter found a book where she works, the USS Ticonderoga book that has a lot of firsthand accounts from the men of the ship in there, and yours is in there. And there's something that you don't mention, but if I flip a few guys further and find Vern Rampa's account, he talks about a pretty gruesome assignment that the two of you had to carry out. What happened there?
Well, we received a phone call from sick bay about the men, some of the men that had, their hands were severely burned, and the ring was still on their finger, and it was killing them, the pain. So they called us up and asked if anything we could do. So my chief, Vern Rampa, said, yeah, let's send them up. So they sent us to the machine shop. And what I had a rag full of cold water and a long-nosed pair of pliers. And I had to dig deep into the wound, the burn, and lift that ring out so that Vern Rampa could grind it and cut it in half and we could take it off. And I think we did five or six of them.
And you had to do this because if you don't do that, they're going to lose those ring fingers. But what were those guys going through? I mean, are they screaming in pain? Are they gritting their teeth? And what did that feel like for you to be sticking those pliers in there?
Well, they were they were men, you know. They weren't crying. They knew we were trying to do the job, and that's what we did. And, you know what? It doesn't take long before you become a man when you're in the service. And that's what happens, you know. We're no longer kids. We're men.
And I know this is a little extraneous, but I'm thinking there might be some wives out there who are saying, well, did they save those wedding rings or did they get rid of them?
I have no idea what happened to them.
Wasn't a priority at that point, huh?
No, not at all.
And you mentioned that during this whole time, you still haven't seen the damage that those kamikazes inflicted. When you did, when you got topside and you saw with your own eyes the aftermath, the damage, the devastation, what was that like for you?
Well, of course, you know, I was amazed, but by that time, it was all over. Now, there you go again, you know. You're men, you just have to go around and do what you have to do to take care of everything and make sure everything goes back to normal, and that's what we did.
Did you do something to recognize or honor or memorialize the guys who had been killed?
Well, the people were killed. There's nothing we could do for them. So they had a ceremony, and it was nothing we could do. We had nothing that we could do for the poor dead people. And who knew how long we were going to stay out at sea? Nobody knew that. So they had a program where they buried them at sea. And they covered them up, and they just... They were in a stretcher or something like that, and they tilted the stretcher, and the poor boys went overseas into the ocean, and it was not a very pleasant thing to see.
Well, and you've already told us your best friend was one of them, but is there also part of you that where it registers, hey, that could be me that they're dropping into the water?
Well, of course, that could have happened to anybody. Fortunately, I was down below decks, and I didn't have any problems at all, personally. Of course, I told you the story about what we had to do.
Have you ever gone to any ship's reunions for the Ticonderoga?
Yes, we did. My wife received a phone call, and it was from a man that was helping to try to organize a group for the veterans group. He said to my wife, is it possible your husband was in the Navy during World War II? And she said, yes. Is it possible that he served aboard the USS Ticonderoga? She said, yes. And he said to her, wonderful. He said, my name is Harold Crane, but he says, I changed my name. It used to be Krinowitz. And she says, oh, Stinky Krinowitz. And that's how we got involved with the Veterans Association, and we're all over the place, and they still do it today. But I don't go any longer because there's nobody I know anymore. They're all gone.
Well, and one of the reasons I asked about the reunions, I was wondering if you ever encountered any of those guys whose fingers you saved by getting their rings off.
I don't think I ever did.
Have you ever wondered what happened to them and how their lives turned out?
No, I knew they were okay. You know, you should have seen the expression on their face when those rings came off.
Relief or pain?
Relief and pain.
Well, and the other thing that I have to ask you about, and I understand maybe it's not something that's easy to talk about, but your friend Eddie Mazur, I'm sure that experience as a 20-year-old is not something that anything could prepare you for. But in all the years since, have you ever thought, what would Eddie have done with his life? What kind of a human being, what kind of an American would he have been?
Well, I knew what kind of American he was and what kind of a human he was. But I'm sure he was pretty clever. I'm sure he would have made a fine living for himself.
And pretty strong, it sounds like, too.
Yes, he was.
You know, he's one of the more than 406,000 Americans who lost their lives in World War II. That's so long ago and so far away, and for most of the people listening, before they were even born. So what do we need to know about those men? How should they be remembered today?
Well, I think everybody remembers them the same way. They were all heroes. They were all heroes. And even today, I wear my World War II cap, and I have people come over to me and say thank you for your service.
And we had the chance to share those words with Bob when we met him in September of 2018 and shared that story with you here on the radio. At the time, he was approaching 95,000 miles on his bicycle and shooting for 100,000. But he had never gotten to talk to the family of his best friend, Eddie Mazur, who gave his life for our country 75 years ago this week. That is no longer the case, and we'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.